I was counting on like 10 more minutes of birthdays, so I wouldn't have to like go as deep, but I'll try my best and see what I can do. Hi, Denisha. I worked with Denisha a long time ago, and I was always giving her shit for that weed thing on her arm. She still has it, apparently. So I'm Lane. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 29th, 2013, so my birthday's on Wednesday, actually. And it's not my first birthday. It's not my first sobriety date. But to me, it's the most important one, and I'll kind of get into that a little bit. I've relapsed a couple times since I've been in AA, and I'll talk about that later. I want to thank Kristen for asking me to speak. I don't do this very often, and it's really nerve-wracking for those of you that haven't. And I did just speak at the Golden Group, so I want to apologize to the people that were there, because you're probably going to hear the exact same story. One thing is I do love talking, and I do love talking about myself, so I should be able to do this. I want to thank my little row of friends that, well, I don't know if they came to see me, but Erica's my sponsor, and Erica's been my sponsor for a long time. I don't think we know exactly how long, but for about 6 years, I think. And you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. And if you don't have a sponsor that you can share pretty much everything with, that can like see right through your bullshit, and I apologize because I'm probably going to cuss. So if you don't have that person that's willing to risk your feelings or hurt your feelings to save your life, then I don't know. That wouldn't work for me. I don't want to tell you how to run your program, but... I have a really good relationship with my sponsor, and she's always there for me, and I want to, you know, always be there for her as well. So I'll kind of just start out and tell you a little bit about what it was like. I'm going to be 50 this year, which I know is shocking. And I grew up in this little ho-dunk town that we're all in, and I come from a really good family. My parents, I believe, are normies. And my siblings and I, a good percentage of us struggle with some sort of addiction. And I don't know how that happens, but, it happened. And I was born here. I was raised here. I had a great childhood. My parents provided very well for us. I didn't get into a lot of trouble as a kid. I think we all remember that like first drink, or for me it was like that first cigarette, you know, just kind of being bad. I remember I was in about seventh grade. I feel like everyone kind of starts drinking in seventh grade. Unless you're a parent, then maybe they don't start that early, but I think they do. And I remember going behind Rice Park with a friend of mine, and I was spending the night at her house, and she happened to have a moped, which, you know, back in the day, you could just ride around town on a moped I don't even think you needed your license back then. And her mom was gone, of course, and I think as a kid, too, you always look for the friends who has very little parental supervision. So then, because at my house, my parents were on top of what I was doing. So I always liked the friends whose parents really didn't give a shit what they were doing, because then I could kind of do whatever I wanted. So this friend and I, we decided to kind of experiment with alcohol, and we found, I think it was vodka, I don't know, it was clear. And I thought this was a brilliant idea, but we put it in a blender with rainbow sherbet. And it was actually fantastic. And we got on our moped, no helmet, no shoes, and just cruised around Santa Maria. And man, we felt good. Got a couple drinks in us, and it was like, yeah, this is freedom right here. And then I remember also trying smoking with this same friend, smoking cigarettes. And yeah, I had some really good times hanging out with this girl. And then I went to high school here. I went to San Maria High. And I kind of experimented with alcohol, but not a lot. Not as much as probably some of my friends were. You know, I remember drinking peppermint schnapps under the bleachers at Santa Maria High. And that seems kind of to be the thing to do. And I was always, at this point when I was in high school, I kind of realized that I was kind of not, already back then, not really like my fellows. I've always been kind of chubby. And so I had kind of some issues with that. But I was always funny, and I was always athletic. So I was always like on the cusp of the popular group, but not really. Like I was just kind of on the outskirts. And I could hang with them, and then there were times when I wasn't a part of that clique. And, you know, as a teenager, I'm gay, and I didn't really put it together back then, although I probably should have. So that, in retrospect, was accounted for a lot of my insecurities, and my not fitting in, and my feeling different and not feeling like I'm cool, not being totally comfortable around boys, being really comfortable around girls. And so, you know, and that's a hard thing for a kid to be that young and to know that you have this and you know your family's not going to be super cool with this and this little town where I'm living may not be super cool with this. And so, yeah. So I went away to school. I went to school in Irvine, and it was like, you know, the floodgates open when you get away from mom and dad a little bit, and you have some money in your pocket. And I had a job, and so now my world was a little bigger, right? I got out of Santa Maria. I was living down south, Southern California. And people were drinking. That's what people do in school. And I joined that group, but not to an extent where it didn't cause me any problems at that point. You know, I was still just kind of the fun party girl, would drink whenever, mostly because I was feeling socially really awkward, because I wasn't fitting in with the 99% of the hetero people that I was hanging out with. I wasn't out at the time. So I was drinking a lot just to kind of feel like I fit in, like I was, you know, I could relate to you, you could relate to me. So I get through school and I get my first like kind of real job, and I was starting to feel really self-conscious about myself, and I've always weight's always been an issue for me. And I think a lot of women, we kind of go through this. It's just a thing. I think women are sucked into. So I was talking to some friends, and I'm like, I really want to lose weight, but I don't want to exercise, and I don't want to eat right, but I just want this miracle cure. And this girl said, well, I just happen to have something for you. And granted, at this time, I'm not a big drinker, but I'm willing to try what she has. So my first addiction was to drugs. I got really, really into meth. I was young at this point, you guys. I was like in my mid-20s. It was this secret little world that I lived in, you know, down south, doing meth with my coworkers, and I didn't know that other people were doing this. I was like, this stuff is fucking fantastic. I can stay up all night. I can go to work. I can write the most amazing poems. I'm sure everything I did in life, I was just doing at an amazing, awesome rate because I was high as a kite for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. But I was always just able to stay under the radar with work, with relationships, with my family. I always did enough to get by, you know. I never kind of over excelled at anything. I was just always like right there. I was doing enough drugs to still have fun, to lose weight, to keep my job, to keep my relationships. And I was able to do that for a while. And then it wasn't until I actually was in my first relationship that I mentioned to this person, I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of a drug user. And she was like, that is not going to work. So she was like, you need to stop that. And so I put down meth and I picked up booze. And I was on. Once I started drinking, I was like, okay, I can do this. I can stop doing drugs. I can just drink, and I can still continue to have some sort of social lubricant, was what I was looking for most of the time. So at this point, I'm like 30, I want to say, and I moved to San Diego, and I got fully immersed in like the club scene, the gay scene down there. Again, it's different when you live in a big city because no one really cares what you do. And so I had a really good job, and I'm hanging out in Hillcrest in San Diego, for any of you that know down there. It's just a really fun city. And I start hanging out in bars. I start drinking at home. You know, and I'm having a really good time with it. Alcohol is really fun. And it was really fun for me for a lot of years. And I didn't have any issues for a long time. I was able to, you know, drink at night, go out with my friends, every once in a while do some drugs, still keep my job, still look good. And let's go back to that. I really care about what you think of me. And I really care about how you view me. And to me, that's a curse that my mother gave me. Because I want you to think I have my shit together. I want you to think that BMW I drive is indicative of how great my life is, when the reality is I can barely pay for that car. And, you know, I'm buying most of my clothes on credit and spending whatever money else I have at a bar. And I'm buying you drinks because I want you to be my friend. And I want you to think that I'm like this big shot, because I'm afraid that if I don't do those things, you're not going to like me just for who I am. Because at this point, I still don't know who I am. So how could I expect you to know who I am? I know I'm getting kind of deep, but so I'm having the time of my life living in San Diego and partying in all these gay bars. And it was probably when I was around 35, so that was, 15 years ago, that little things started happening. And I think anybody that's had a little run out there drinking and partying, we all kind of experienced the same things. Like, I've never been arrested, but there's been lots of little incidents where I should have been arrested. And I started having little issues where I would get in little fender benders, where I would be drinking and I would hit some, you know, lady's car as she's, you know, leaving her hairdresser. And I like to think I'm kind of charming. And so I was kind of always able to talk my way out of these situations. Like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, my dog just died. I'm having a terrible day. And again, I'm still able to just kind of fly under the radar without really having any consequences to my behavior. So I'll tell you guys a couple drunk stories, just because I feel like that's the best part of my story. The last time I spoke, I was telling them, I hadn't thought of, it's funny how we experience things in life that we remember that we did like back in the day. So I was thinking a couple weeks ago about when Prince died, that I'd gone to a Prince concert. and it was at San Diego State, and like a whole group of us went, and I don't know how much the tickets cost, but I'm sure they were, you know, I don't know, $100 maybe. So we get all dolled up, we like pre-party, we have our whole thing, and my friend and I, we never even went in the damn concert. Because we thought our sorry asses were having a good time out front, like sitting like homeless people, no offense to homeless people, but outside of San Diego State, just like out in the parking lot drinking whatever we brought. We never once went into that concert. And I remember my girlfriend at the time was so pissed at me when she walked out of there that she left my friend who lived in Los Angeles, and she just left her there. She was like, I'm so done with you guys. Like, why do you guys keep doing these kinds of things? Or we would go to, we loved to travel, my partner at the time, but we never went anywhere like, we never went to like Rome or to see the pyramids. We always had to go somewhere tropical, right? Because when you're on vacation somewhere tropical, your ass can sit at the pool all day and drink, and you don't feel guilty about it because you're like, I'm on vacation. So I remember going to like, I don't know, we went to like the Cayman Islands or something, and we're with another couple, and we have this big day planned where we're going to go like scuba diving. And I'm thinking, I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not here to see any damn fish under there. I'm thinking my body's not very buoyant anyway, or it is buoyant, I don't know. It is or it isn't. Anyway, I'm thinking, I don't really want to do that. So I sat in the bar with like two guys from Texas who were like my best friends by the end of the trip. I couldn't tell you what their names were, but so while my friends are like having all these experiences and making all these memories, I'm sitting in a bar with like Dumb and Dumber proving that I can drink more than they can, and I'm probably paying their bill too, so that they'll want to hang out with me. Another thing I remember was I got to the point in my drinking where I was drinking at work. And, you know, I hear people come in here and say, well, I guess our bottoms are all different, right? We all experience a different type of bottom. I feel like my bottom was kind of bad. And I drank at work, and I did it really well for a long time. And, you know, I would have the vodka in my desk with Gatorade. I was always the queen of Gatorade and vodka. And I think people just thought I was trying to hydrate all the time. But it was usually just mostly vodka. And so on this one particular day, I was getting ready to come to Santa Maria. It was like my dad's birthday or something. And so I went to the store because I had a friend that was going to house sit for me with my pets. And so I was buying her like sandwich stuff so she would have like lunch and stuff. And because I'm drunk, but I'm still Martha Stewart. You know, I'm still going to take care of people. So I'm buying a bunch of wine for my dad's party. And I bought like a big handle of, I think, Stoli. And I'm going out to Vaughn's. There used to be this kind of ghetto Vaughn's in San Diego. Well, I'm sure there's many ghetto Vaughn's in San Diego. But I was at this particular ghetto Vaughn's. And so I'm loading up my cart, and it's early. It's like maybe 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And this homeless guy sees me, and he comes up to me, and he was like, hey, I was wondering if you could give me some wine. And I'm like, dude, I don't even have like a corkscrew. I mean, like I needed that anyway. And I swear I could cork a bottle of wine with my teeth. And he's like, well, maybe you could give me some of your vodka then, because I know you have a big old bottle of vodka. And I was like, I said, no. I said, but I'm going to make you a sandwich. I'm going to make you a sandwich right here in the back of my BMW. So I'm getting all my shit out, right? I'm like, it's like Subway over there. I have it all spread out. I make him a really, really good sandwich. Probably gave him like extra cheese. I don't know. And then I'm feeling bad for him. And he's like, okay, can you at least give me a little bit of vodka? And I'm like, okay. So I pour out a water bottle. I pour some vodka in. And all of a sudden, this cop comes, and he, like, pins us, like, in. And I'm like, hey, officer. And he's like, what the F are you doing? And I was like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, I'm making him a sandwich. Like, I'm like a good Samaritan. Like, I don't understand what the problem is. And he's like, well, I saw you pour that water bottle out, and I saw you put vodka in there. And he's like, I'm not sure if you know that there's a lot of homeless people that live in San Diego. And when you're providing them alcohol, you're making my job a lot harder. And so that was just another incident of me almost kind of doing some stupid stuff with the law, but just kind of able to just kind of keep it in check. And that cop ended up letting me go, but he did pour that poor guy's vodka out. I felt really bad for him. He never got it, but... So I'm living in San Diego, and I at this point I'm living, if you guys know where Laurel Street is in San Diego, it's right above the airport. There's a big hill. I think Top Gun, they filmed like a scene right on that hill. And I'm drinking like crazy. I'm no longer in a relationship, so now I have nobody to even answer to. I can do whatever I want. And for me, as soon as I was no longer accountable to that other person was when my drinking took off. So, if you really want to party, don't be in a relationship. So I get out of this relationship that I'm in because I'm already being scandalous. I'm not being a good partner. I'm going out at night. I'm doing all the things that we do. And I'm not feeling that great about it, but oh well. So now I'm living on my own, and my drinking's progressing really, really, really bad. I'm going to hurry up. And I'm drinking at work, I'm drinking in the morning, I'm drinking at night. It's just, 24/7. I'm waking up in the middle of the night. For those of you that really like to drink, we wake up in the middle of the night to drink because you're shaking. At like 3 in the morning, I'd watch this talk show on ESPN, Mike and Mike. Where I lived, it was crazy because the trains would go by, the airplanes would go by, the cruise ships would come in, and I was just like, jeez Louise. And here I am at 3 in the morning just sitting there drinking. And at this point, I'm drinking wine out of a box that my sponsor told me is really just alcohol with food coloring. There's no grapes in it, apparently. And at this point, I lose my job. This really good job where I've worked for a really, really long time. And my supervisor is a very good friend of mine. And I carried a resentment for that woman for years after I was sober. How dare I resent her for letting me go because I have a drinking problem. And I was let go from that job, and I did what any responsible alcoholic does, and I took all kinds of money out of my 401k. And I, went to Hawaii and continued my party over there. And just, I had no responsibilities whatsoever. And I started noticing, I went to my ex-girlfriend's house. We shared dogs. And you know when you're lesbians, you don't have kids, so you share dogs. And not all lesbians, so nobody get pissed off. I'm just saying some. You share dogs, usually big dogs. And so she was gone. I don't know where she was. I was with our dogs, and I went to her house, and I took some vodka. I took like some juice, whatever she had. Basically, I took. And I'm walking down her stairs, and I'm starting to feel this like weird numbness in my body. And I had been feeling this for a while. And I fell going down her front stairs, and I broke my arm. And I couldn't get up, and this vodka bottle that I had shattered all over the place. And these Jehovah's Witness guys come walking up. And they're like, ma'am, are you okay? And I'm like, dude, do I fucking look okay? Like, I'm not okay. I have a broken arm. More importantly, the vodka bottle broke. I'm at my ex-girlfriend's house. My dogs are watching all this. And no, I'm not okay. So my neighbor came and took me to the hospital, and the doctor told me there that he thought I had like alcoholic hepatitis because my eyes were yellow. And he's like, I think there's something wrong with you. And this numbness that I was feeling, like my knees would just give out at any minute. I was like the little Gumby guy. I would just be walking down the street and I would fall, like bad. But did that make me stop drinking? The fact that my doctor told me my liver was all screwed up. Now I have this random numbness. I have no job. I'm going to a doctor in a clinic in San Diego, which if you've ever been to one of those in San Diego, it's not fun. And I'm drinking beer, which I wasn't really a beer drinker, but I was buying like the Budweiser 3-pack with like the crazy cellophane that holds it together. And I still thought I had it going on, you guys. I was like, I'm still doing this. And it was at that point that my family got wind of what was going on with me, and they moved me to Santa Maria because my house was a mess, I was a mess, and my bank account was a mess, and I was dying, basically. And I saw a doctor here, and he told me that I had neuropathy, which I guess a lot of diabetic people get it, but alcohol can give it to you as well, where my feet feel like there's like pins in, you know, like when your feet fall asleep, when you sit on your foot for too long. I have that feeling all the time, and I will for the rest of my life. It'll never go away. And at the time, I had it in my hands. I had it like in my waist. It was really, really bad. And my doctor told me, you need to stop drinking. But, you know, at that point, I had lost the power of choice, you guys. It wasn't about it. If I could decide to stop drinking, I would have. But I didn't have it in me to just make that choice that I was no longer going to drink. So I continued drinking for a couple months after that. And I was just getting crazier and crazier. And then I remember one day my sister, you know, it takes what it takes, right, for us to get sober. My nephew had a baby, and they wouldn't let me hold her. He said, no, if you're drinking, our rule is if you're drinking, you don't get to hold the baby. And I was like, what? Like, me? Drinking? Just because my arm's broken and my eyes are yellow, I don't see what the problem is. And so that was like my aha moment, you know? And that was the moment that was what worked for me at that time in my life to give me that motivation, like, oh, shit, this is, like, for real now. And I remember my dad begged me to go into sober living, begged me. And my dad has never asked me for anything in my life, and he's given me everything. So I went and I lived at ASA for, like, all you old school Santa Maria people. Daniel would always come over there and Jim. And so I'm living in the sober living with other humans, right? guys and girls, and I'm sharing a room with people. I'm sharing a bathroom. And talk about humility, you guys. It was a very humbling experience for me, for this little spoiled girl to suddenly be living in sober living with, I don't know, like 10 other people. And I loved it, you guys. I loved it. For the first time in my life, I felt like I was at summer camp. You know, it's like I didn't have to have a job. I got to come to meetings. There were donuts. You know, my mom and dad were off my back. They were happy as long as I was doing what I needed to be doing. And so I got sober for the first time, going to like 2 or 3 meetings a day. I didn't work for a couple years. And I was on a pink cloud for a really long time that first time I got sober. I hung out here a lot. I hung out at the Alano Club. I never thought I'd miss that Alano Club, but I really do, for those of us that were around back then. We thought it was terrible then, but now I really miss it. So I was going to a ton of meetings, and I started sponsoring a ton of girls. And I remember I had a sponsor that lived up in Paso, and she was like, she pulled me aside one day, and she goes, "You know that sponsoring people, it's not about you, right?" And I was like, "What?" I'm like, "I'm rolling in with a crew to like two meetings a day." And she's like, "Yeah, no, that's not how it's supposed to work. It's not about you. It's not about your ego. It's not about how many people you're sponsoring. It's not about how you and your friggin' crew rolling in." And I had to learn that lesson, that me sponsoring people, it was about their recovery, not mine. And it was about mine. It helped me stay sober. And so after a couple years, I started working in recovery, and I was working at Project Preemie. I'm gonna tell you this one quick story. I was living with my niece at the time, who she had just got married. Her husband had been stationed in Afghanistan. He was a young kid. He was like 23 years old. And they asked if I would live with them while he was gone, so that she wouldn't be by herself. So I'm working at Project Preemie. I'm doing my thing. I'm, you know, just rocking this recovery. And one day, you know, I went to open my blinds, and I see the friggin' Air Force guys get out of the car with a nurse, and, like, I think they had a pastor. And, you know, they come knocking to the door, and you know, I don't even need to answer it. I know why they're there. And that was the worst day of my life when that happened. And the first thing I did, and you guys, I don't do AA right by any means, but the first thing I did that day was I called the woman who was my sponsor at the time. And I was like, what do I do? Like, how am I supposed to tell my niece that this young guy that she just married like 5 weeks ago is dead? Like, how do I do this? Walk me through this. And I was able to just kind of step back from that situation, from the things that I learned in AA, and I was able to pause. I was able to come up with a plan before I reacted. And what I did was I called my brother and I said, "I need you to come over here. I need to talk to you in person." And that day, I think we have defining moments in life. That day, God showed me how strong I am. You know, I always had these little insecurities, and I wasn't quite sure of my place in life or what I was doing and who I was doing it with. But that day, God definitely said, "You are one tough cookie, and you can handle this. You can be a rock for your family right now." And the women in AA were a rock for me when I couldn't be. So, you know, getting past that, and then I'm working, like I said, I'm working in recovery. I was like a month short of 5 years. And I walked into a Fresh and Easy, and I bought a bottle of wine just like that. Like, no. Nothing was really going wrong in my life. I'm a bad picker when it comes to dating, and I know that. It's a trigger for me. I can handle crazy, crazy hard things in life, but women just, like, it's bad for me, and I know that now, and I can admit that in front of all of you people. So, I walked into a Fresh and Easy on a Thursday night. I was supposed to be at my women's meeting that I go to every Thursday night, but instead I decided to drink. And let me just tell you guys, it takes you right back to where you left off. Because I honestly thought that I could just have like one bottle of wine and watch, what's that show with Jax Taylor, the really hot guy? The motorcycle show. I don't know. Sons of Anarchy. I thought I could do that. I thought I could just drink some wine, watch Sons of Anarchy, and that I could just kind of chill. And 2 days later, you guys, I was like holed up in my room, drinking vodka, obsessing, that mental obsession, as soon as you take that first drink, I thought of nothing else. And the women in AA, I lived in this gated community, and somebody found out I was drunk, I don't know who. But they were like trying to like climb my fence to get in there. And they 12-stepped me. Like, and we don't see that as much anymore where we go out and we talk to drunks. But my group of friends did. They came and they saw me drunk. And I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sponsoring people at the time, and my sponsees saw me like that. And so now not only did I fuck up my recovery, but I'm putting other people's recovery in jeopardy too, which is like so selfish. And today, I you know, in hindsight, I know that. So I was able to get sober again, and then I relapsed again for about 4 days. And this one was really mellow, just kind of a bump in the road, mellow relapse. But nonetheless, those feelings come back of shame and guilt and what have I done? I'm disappointing my family. And I remember telling my mom and dad that I was drinking again. And God, if you have parents that care about you and you do that to them over and over again, it's heartbreaking. And I, of course, chose to tell my parents in Panda Express, because that's a good place to tell people you realize. It's like, pass an egg roll, by the way, I'm drinking. And at this point, my parents put me up in a really like fancy rehab, and I got another chance. So now I'm on like my third chance, and that's the sobriety date that I have now. Is the date that my brother drove me to Orange County to go to this rehab. And, you know, there, you guys, I really learned about a lot of stuff with codependency. I started seeing a therapist on a regular basis. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's not enough for me. I needed more. I needed somebody to help me with all the other shit in my life. I mean, alcohol is just a symptom. So how am I going to deal with all that other stuff? And living sober and being happy. And so I started seeing a therapist on a regular basis. And she had me doing like intense groups with other women. Not necessarily addicts or alcoholics, just people that were having issues in life. And when you get a group of women together, the bond and the strength that can be formed is, it's like no other, you know. And that's why they say in AA, the women stick together. And so I got sober that time. Like I said, that'll be 3 years in on Wednesday. And I started all over with, you know, Erica hung in there with me as my sponsor. And I just started from the beginning. And sometimes when life gets crazy, you know, the best thing you can do is go back to the basics. You know, what did you learn your first week in AA? You know, I remember coming, this was the first meeting I came to, and I was drunk. And somebody gave me a big book, and they remembered my name. And I remember how I felt when somebody came after me and said, hey, Lane, do you have a big book? And it's those little things that people do in Alcoholics Anonymous that we remember when we start to feel a little antsy or a little hopeless, that there's people that really do care. I can't tell you how many times Louise moved me. You know, people in AA, they just pitch in and help out. I mean, I can't think of a better group of people I would want on my side other than, you know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got sober again, and I don't want to, like, say that my relapse was a good thing, but it was, you know. I was again, sober and somewhat successful, but still just kind of under the radar, you know. I'm working in, you know, recovery, you know, my ego's this huge. And it's like the same feelings as I'm drinking, but I'm not physically drinking. And so I, this time around, I think I know it's different because I feel a sense of humility that I've never had before. And that's something that I think takes time, you know? And I know now that it's not all about me. It's not all about how many people I'm sponsoring or how many people I'm hanging out with or what kind of car I drive. And that relapse forced me to get my shit together, which, you know, we can only stay sober without progressing for so long. It's like I got sober to have a life. I didn't get sober to just, like, live at my sister's house forever. So that relapse helped me to actually get a career again and to have a job that I can be proud of doing. And to, like, I pay my own bills now, you guys. Like, my dad does not buy my gas anymore. And you would think at 50, your dad wouldn't have to give you a Chevron card. But, you know, it takes time. And so I know that for all of us, it's different how we can measure whether or not we're where we're supposed to be. I had a situation this weekend where somebody that I really care about was put in a really traumatic situation, and I was able to be there for her again in a way that I was able to be of strength and deal with a crisis when this person needed me and not fall apart and not say, oh my God, I need, you know, 3 Ativan to deal with this. And that wasn't always me. I have not always been like that. And, you know, I have a job where I work in crisis. And that was a gift that God gave me that I never knew I had. And it's a gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, to be able to do this and to be able to do what I do in life and to be able to give back. I may not go to as many meetings as I used to. I mean, I don't want to get up here and say that I'm doing everything right, because I'm not. I very rarely call my sponsor, you guys. But if it's important enough, I do. And I do try to make it to, for me, it's all about the women's meetings and the relationships that I have with women that I've known for, you know, 8 years since I've been here. And it's the women that know when I'm bullshitting them. And it's the women that know when I need that extra push. And so I don't do everything right, but in the last almost 3 years, I haven't picked up a drink. And more importantly, I haven't been miserable, because I didn't get sober to be miserable and to be sitting on my couch white-knuckling it. And I'm not that person that doesn't think about it. That's not my story. I wasn't blessed with that, oh, I had this like crazy spiritual awakening and now I never want to drink again. You guys, I think about it. I think about it probably more than I should, but I don't act on it. Because I know that, like, because for me, what I want to do is I see all my neighbors out there drinking, and I want to be able to drink like a normal person. And I want to be able to go to the Cliffs and have, like, a nice little, you know, salad, which I never eat salads, and a nice little pink drink with, like, a flower floating in it, right? That's what I want. But the reality is that I'll do that, and then I'll immediately go home and buy the cheapest whatever I can find, and I'll, you know, hole up in my house, and I won't leave, and I won't want to talk to anybody because I become very antisocial. And then I break all those relationships with the people in my family and my job. And you know, like 4 or 5 things that I can name that if I drink, I will lose. And so some days it's just as simple as I want to drink, but I'm not going to. And that's okay. That's okay. And sometimes I have to tell myself, you're not drinking today. We'll relook at this tomorrow. Because chances are tomorrow I'm not going to have this feeling. Because I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that feelings aren't facts. And we just have to keep trudging. So thank you, guys.